The Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard, continued. Disc 8.
Pierre d'Orsay, captain of the French slaver La Concorde, could not have been happy to see two large sloops approaching from the west. He knew it meant trouble. Because of the prevailing winds, many ships sailed to the Caribbean at this latitude, but nobody sailed in the opposite direction. La Concorde was a large, swift, powerful vessel, a 250-ton ship-rigged slaver, with a strong oaken hull and enough gun ports to accommodate up to 40 cannon. However, D'Orsay's crew was in no condition to go into battle. The Frenchmen had left their home port of Nantes 8 months earlier, with a crew of 75 and holds filled with goods to trade with the kings and princes of Whydah, on Africa's Bight of Benin. La Concorde's owner, the merchant René Montaudoin, had given Captain D'Orsay a competitive advantage over the captains of rival slavers, a cargo the Africans would pay many slaves to possess. The people of the Kingdom of Whydah had a penchant for the colorful cotton prints produced in India. Montaudoin, the richest man in Nantes, had built his own textile factory near the mouth of the Loire, which turned out knockoffs of the calico and Andean's patterns. With a hold full of colorful cotton, D'Orsay looked forward to a smooth and profitable journey. Things went badly from the start. A few days from Nantes, La Concorde encountered a pair of powerful storms that damaged the ship, causing the loss of an expensive anchor and the death of a crewman who was thrown overboard. They arrived in Whydah in July after 77 days at sea and succeeded in trading their goods for 516 slaves and a small quantity of gold dust. They also picked up enough tropical microbes and bacteria to sicken many of the crew members. 16 crewmen died during their 3-month stay in Africa or during the 6 weeks they had been crossing the Atlantic. 36 others were sick with scurvy and the bloody flux. 61 slaves had also died. Now D'Orsay feared he might not make it to the slave markets of Martinique at all. With 70% of his crew dead or incapacitated, D'Orsay lacked the manpower to handle the ship's cannon and rigging at the same time. A captain in his situation could bluff, displaying his guns to ward off the attackers. But on this occasion, D'Orsay was deprived of that option as well. Because he was carrying an unusually large number of slaves, nearly 100 more than in any of La Concorde's previous trips, they had to increase their cargo capacity by mounting only 16 guns. If the strangers turned out to be pirates, D'Orsay knew he was in trouble. As the sloops closed within range, he and his lieutenant, François Ernault, must have felt a growing sense of terror. A spyglass revealed two sloops of war with guns run out of their ports and their decks jammed with men. Any further doubt about their intentions vanished when the sloops displayed a black flag with a death's head, and smoke and fire began to swirl around the head of the fearsome bearded man on the biggest sloop's quarterdeck. Puffs of smoke appeared along the length of one of the sloops as she fired a full volley of cannon at La Concorde. Cannonballs splashed in the water and flew over the deck, followed shortly by a cascade of musket balls. D'Orsay stayed the course and tried to rally his crewmen, but a second volley of cannon and musketry sapped the last bit of morale from the French crew. D'Orsay ordered the flag struck, and the helmsman swung La Concorde into the wind, and she drifted slowly to a stop. Monsieur Montaudoin was going to be very angry. As he looked over his new prize, Blackbeard knew he had finally found a proper flagship. La Concorde was as big, fast, and powerful as Bellamy's now infamous Whydah, maybe more so. With such a vessel, Blackbeard knew his men could cause more havoc than the rest of the old flying gang put together. All the French slaver needed was a little refitting and a change of name. The pirates took La Concorde to Bahia, a hilly, forested island with a large protected anchorage located 9 miles southeast of St. Vincent, an island in the Windward Chain. Blackbeard knew they were unlikely to be bothered here, for unlike most of the surrounding islands, St. Vincent and Bahia were not controlled by Europeans, but by the mixed-race descendants of Carib Indians and the African survivors of the 1635 wreck of two slave ships. These people, the Garifuna, had tenaciously defended their land from the Europeans, but their naval operations were limited to a handful of Carib-style war canoes. Even if they did show up in force, they were likely as not to be pleased with the pirates for stopping a slave ship from reaching its destination. The hundreds of slaves in La Concorde's hold had little reason to celebrate, however. While Blackbeard had several crewmen of African descent, these men had probably been born in the West Indies, blacks familiar with European customs, language, and technology. Most Africans Blackbeard's men encountered, literally, straight off the boat, appear to have been treated as cargo, as creatures from an alien culture who were ineligible to join the pirates' ranks. They turned the vast majority of the 455 slaves, chained in La Concorde's hold, over to Captain D'Orsay, whose men guarded them on the shore of Bahia. Blackbeard kept 61 slaves aboard La Concorde, probably to use as laborers, although a few may have been inducted into his company. On this point, sadly, the historical record has little to say. The pirates did force 10 of D'Orsay's crewmen, and their choice illustrates their company's needs. The chief surgeon and his deputy, a pilot, both gunsmiths, the master carpenter and his deputy, an expert in the art of caulking hulls, a cook, and one seaman with unspecified skills. In addition, 4 of D'Orsay's men begged the pirates to let them join, including the coxswain and both of his cabin boys. The boys, 15-year-old Louis Arrault and slightly older Julien Joseph Moisson, were the worst-paid members of the slaver's crew, receiving a paltry 5 and 8 livres, 0.2 and 0.35 pounds a month, respectively. Young Arrault may have had reason to dislike D'Orsay and his officers, because he went out of his way to cause them harm, informing the pirates that they had a secret stash of gold dust hidden somewhere on the ship or their persons. Blackbeard's men interrogated D'Orsay and his officers, threatening to cut their throats if they failed to turn over the gold. The Frenchmen complied and were eventually rewarded with the means to get themselves and their slaves back to Martinique. The pirates exchanged their smaller 40-ton sloop, which they had disarmed, in favor of La Concorde. The pirates also gave them 2 or 3 tons of beans to prevent the slaves from starving. D'Orsay dubbed this sloop the Mauvaise Rencontre, the Bad Encounter, and used it to transport his crew and slaves back to Martinique, a task that took 2 separate voyages. Blackbeard oversaw the transfer of his personal effects from the Revenge to La Concorde, along with cannon and supplies from the 40-ton sloop and much of the pirate company. Stede Bonnet had recovered from his battle wounds, and despite the Barbadians' inexperience, Blackbeard allowed him to resume command of the Revenge and a crew of at least 50 men. From eyewitness accounts a few days later, we know that La Concorde was now mounted with 22 guns and had a crew of 150 men, indicating that at least some of the Africans retained by the pirates had been inducted into the crew. The pirates also gave La Concorde a new name, Queen Anne's Revenge. The choice of names suggests Jacobite political leanings among Blackbeard's crew, evoking the name of the last Stuart monarch and promising vengeance in her name against King George and his Hanoverian line. Now in command of a powerful warship, Blackbeard was ready to wreak havoc. He was by now aware of the relatively weak state of the European colonies in the Lesser Antilles, which Sam Bellamy's men would have attested to on the basis of their raids the year before. He proposed to the company that they sweep the 1,400-mile island chain from end to end, raiding ships and harbors alike until they reached the Windward Passage, where they might snare a Spanish galleon carrying the payroll to Cuba. This strategy agreed upon, the Revenge and Queen Anne's Revenge sailed out of the harbor to the south, a course set for Grenada, the first island in the chain. When they reached the French island, they would backtrack their way to St. Vincent and continue north, hopping from island to island and stripping them of valuables as if they were walking through a row of fruit trees. The first leg of the journey, which lasted but 2 days, was of mixed success. Despite, or possibly because of, the presence of their French pilot, the pirates managed to run one of their vessels aground on Grenada. They were able to get her off whatever reef she had struck, and while it didn't suffer any serious damage, the pirates did find it necessary to abandon a number of the slaves. Dacé was later able to recover them, in part because he had branded them with La Concorde's initials. But they also made their first capture, a large brigantine, a seaworthy, two-masted vessel armed with 10 guns. No account of the capture of this vessel survives, so there is no way of knowing where she came from or what was on board. But the pirates kept her as a third member of their fleet. Presumably, a few of her crew were forced into service, and the remainder released on one of the ship's boats or put ashore on St. Lucia. In any event, the pirates acquired this brigantine between the time they left Captain Dacé on Bahia and when they encountered their next quarry, a day or so later, in the deep water passage north of St. Vincent. This was the Great Allan of Boston, a very large merchant ship en route from Barbados to Jamaica. Blackbeard, still furious with Massachusetts authorities, decided to take it out on all of its residents. He allowed the Great Allan's captain, Christopher Taylor, to be roughed up, so that Taylor would reveal the whereabouts of his valuables. The shackled captain either refused to tell or denied there were any riches, apart from whatever they had found in the Great Allan's hold. The pirates didn't believe him, and whipped him soundly. Whether he confessed or not, the pirates ended up with a cup of such exquisite value and workmanship that future captives would remember it above all the riches they saw aboard Blackbeard's ships. Taylor had to watch as the pirates burned his huge ship to the waterline. The next day, Taylor and his crew were put aboard a boat and were rowed to a sparsely inhabited shore on Martinique. It would take 3 months for word of the attack to reach the Great Allan's home port of Boston. By then, the fate of Bellamy's crewmen had already been sealed. Blackbeard's men confirmed that they had little to fear from French authorities in that part of the Caribbean. Martinique, a sugar colony with a population of 9,400 whites and over 29,000 slaves, was the center of France's West Indies Empire, but it had no naval protection of any kind. Blackbeard would have been dissuaded from attacking the harbor itself by the presence of Fort Royal, her thick walls and heavy guns providing ample protection. However, Guadeloupe, Martinique's sister colony, 75 miles to the north, was not so strongly fortified, a fact the pirates would have learned by interrogating Dacé and his crew. It was there that Blackbeard would make the first of many brash incursions into the very capitals of Europe's American colonies. We know only a few details of the attack on Guadeloupe town, which likely took place on the night of November 28, 1717. The pirates had sailed straight into the harbor, guns blazing, before the ships at anchor could get underway. They seized control of a large French ship that had just finished taking on a cargo of sugar, raising her sails and hacking away her anchor lines to make a quick escape. Then, in the most outrageous move made by a Caribbean pirate to date, they set the town ablaze, probably by firing red-hot cannonballs into its rows of neat wooden homes. As they sailed out of the port, a growing plume of smoke rose behind them. By the time the island's residents were able to get the conflagration under control, half of Guadeloupe town lay in ashes. The morning of the 29th found the pirates sailing north on a light wind with their big French sugar ship, creeping into the 40-mile-wide passage that separated French Guadeloupe from the neighboring English islands of Montserrat, Antigua, and Nevis. A large merchant vessel appeared bearing English colors. Before they had an opportunity to attack, however, several of the ship's men were seen climbing into their longboat. Then, to the pirates' surprise, instead of trying to escape, the boat began rowing straight up to the nearest of their three vessels, Stede Bonnet's Revenge. Bonnet luffed his sails, allowing the boat to come alongside. He looked over the rail and was greeted by a man who introduced himself as Thomas Knight, an officer of the Montserrat Merchant. Knight's commanding officer, Bonnet soon learned, had mistaken the Revenge and Queen Anne's Revenge for a pair of English slavers arriving from Africa, and had sent him over to inquire if they were carrying letters bound for Montserrat or the British Leeward Islands. Bonnet, who must have looked the part of an aristocratic slave trader, introduced himself as Captain Edwards, and told Knight he was bound from Barbados to Jamaica. He said they did indeed have something for them, and insisted they come on board. At this point in the conversation, Knight finally noticed the death's head flag hanging from the Revenge's stern. Trying to conceal his discomfort, Knight politely declined. Bonnet then changed his tone, ordering Knight and his boat crew to come aboard, else he would sink them right then and there. The hapless men did as they were told, scampering onto the deck amid a crowd of armed men. Knight later recalled that, "When we went on board, the first words they said to us were that we were welcome aboard the pirates," meaning their vessel. For the next few hours, Knight and his men were kept in a state of terror and confusion. First, Bonnet's men invited them to a meal. Knight declined. The pirates extended the invitation a second time, this time adding that if it was refused, they would do them mischief. During this compulsory meal, Bonnet and his crew interrogated their guests, gathering intelligence about the British Leeward Islands. How big was Montserrat's fort at Kinsale? How many guns protected the island's principal harbor, Plymouth? And what was the strength of the ships anchored there? Knight told them what he knew. Kinsale's 60-year-old fort had 4 guns, but there were another 7 guarding the entrance to Plymouth. No other ships were armed with anything greater than personal firearms. Then he begged the pirates to release him and his men, or at least put them ashore on Guadeloupe or Montserrat, as the captain of their ship had by now figured out the situation and fled the scene. Bonnet's men refused, saying the captives must go and speak with the man of war, the Queen Anne's Revenge, before they would discharge us. As the day wore on, Bonnet caught up to the Queen Anne's Revenge and the French sugar ship. He came alongside Blackbeard's flagship, close enough to yell a question to his commodore. What should he do with the men they had captured? The word came back to send the captives over in a boat. Knight and his men rowed to the powerful man-of-war, which looked to them to have been built with Dutch lines, fast and agile. As they grew near, someone aboard the great pirate ship hailed them through a speaking trumpet. The message was the same as before: welcome aboard the pirate. Once on the deck of Queen Anne's Revenge, Knight's party was invited to yet another meal. This time they did not refuse. The pirates bragged about their conquests, but concealed their commander's names, calling Bonnet Edwards and claiming Blackbeard's name to be Kentish. Blackbeard did not join them, however, and the captive soon learned that he was ill, probably from a disease carried from Africa in his ex-slave ship. The captain would speak to them later. In the meantime, they were put to work as temporary laborers aboard the ship. The pirates sailed through the night, leaving Montserrat unmolested in favor of Nevis, the second most important island in Britain's Leeward Islands colony, a volcanic peak soaring 3,200 feet out of the shimmering ocean. They reached Nevis at daybreak, and Blackbeard ordered a course for Nevis's main anchorage on the island's western shore. A few hours later, the pirate squadron reached Nevis Harbor, but Blackbeard was so ill he could barely leave his quarters. William Howard, his quartermaster, inspected the vessels anchored against Nevis's sugarcane-fringed shores. There were a variety of merchant vessels for the taking: sloops, sailing canoes, and a few large brigantines, or ships, but there was also a large frigate, which the pirates took to be the warship assigned to the Leeward Islands, the sixth-rate HMS Seaford. The pirates reacted with excitement, not fear. The consensus was that they should pounce on the frigate where she lay, storm her decks, cut her anchor line, and before authorities ashore could react, sail her out to sea. Howard proposed this bold plan to Blackbeard, but the pirate felt too weak to take part in the risky attack and talk the company out of it. There would be other opportunities, he told them, once they were more familiar with their ship and her capabilities. Instead, they should concentrate on easy targets. His argument won the day, and Howard ordered the flotilla to sail for Antigua, the capital of the British Leeward Islands, which they hoped was without naval protection. The pirates sailed under English colors, doing their best to appear to be simple merchant vessels going about their business. En route to Antigua, their three vessels sailed among a pair of unsuspecting merchant ships. Perhaps not wishing to arouse a general alarm, the pirates did not attack. Instead, they sent Bonnet a bit ahead of the other ships in the Revenge to gather more information. As the day progressed, a merchant sloop happened to pass alongside the Revenge. Bonnet or one of his officers hailed it, claiming they were from Barbados. A man aboard the sloop responded that he was Richard Joy, captain and owner of the new division on her way from St. Christopher to Antigua. The pirate said he must come aboard their vessel and promised to do him no harm. When I went on board, they asked me to eat and drink and inquired what vessels were along the shore, Joy later recalled. I could not tell. While Joy was consuming his meal, some of Bonnet's men climbed aboard the new division, took control of the quarterdeck, and forced all its crew back aboard the Revenge. They continued to interrogate Joy, demanding to know what vessels were in St. Christopher Harbor. At first, the merchant pleaded ignorance, but when the pirates threatened to burn his sloop, he told them everything. There were two ships, one newly arrived from Liverpool with a cargo of English foodstuffs. The pirates were pleased at the news, but announced they would sink the new division all the same. Joy approached Bonnet, begging him to let him have his vessel. I told him it was all I had to support my family. Bonnet took pity on the man and told his crew to let him have his sloop, but not to release him until after nightfall. When the new division finally parted from the pirates, Blackbeard's quartermaster, William Howard, allowed Thomas Knight and his men to leave with them. As their captive sailed off, the pirates drew their vessels together for a consultation, and based on their new intelligence, resolved to attack St. Christopher rather than Antigua. The three vessels turned around again, heading northwest toward their new target. Blackbeard's flotilla arrived on November 31st. The English settlers could not have been happy to see the three ships sailing into Sandy Point, black flags flying from the rigging. The settlers, who still hadn't recovered from a severe French attack during the war, were unable to keep up the island's defenses. The guns were rarely in working order, and powder, ammunition, and skilled gunners were in short supply even at the island's principal fort on Brimstone Hill, overlooking the anchorage. The militia had presumably been called up to man what cannon they did have, but were unable to stop Blackbeard's men from seizing and plundering a number of trading sloops. The Liverpool ship was nowhere to be seen. In a symbolic show of contempt for the king's fort, Blackbeard had his men sail their big French sugar ship right under the fort's guns and set her on fire right at the foot of Brimstone Hill. The ship, still loaded with sugar, turned into an inferno, a great plume of acrid smoke drifting over the fort's stone battlements. As the Revenge and Queen Anne's Revenge pulled out of the harbor, the pirates also set several trading sloops on fire, leaving Sandy Point looking as if the French had raided it anew. Blackbeard and Bonnet continued up the Leewards, their vessels laden with silver, gold dust, and sugar. Blackbeard had stolen another six cannon, and as they sailed for the Virgin Islands, his crew mounted them on gun carriages and rolled them into place behind the Queen Anne's Revenge's spare gun ports. Blackbeard's flagship now had 28 2- and 6-pound cannon, with room for another 12. Blackbeard himself had recovered his health and perhaps regretted not attacking what he took to be the HMS Seaford back in Nevis. In truth, the Seaford had not been at Nevis. While Blackbeard and Bonnet were prowling Nevis and St. Christopher, the Seaford was sailing in the Virgin Islands, carrying Governor Walter Hamilton on a tour of his colony's far-flung possessions. The little frigate had just turned around to begin her return trip to Antigua, putting her on a collision course with Blackbeard and Bonnet. Governor Hamilton and the Seaford's captain, Jonathan Rose, were already concerned about their safety. The Seaford was the only warship assigned to the sprawling Leeward Islands colony, but she was one of the Navy's smallest frigates. The 20-year-old vessel was just 93 feet long and 248 tons, with 24 guns and a crew of 85. As usual, many of her men were incapacitated by one tropical disease or another. Governor Hamilton and Captain Rose were both aware she would be no match for a heavily armed pirate sloop and frigate, especially if they were boarded. Indeed, when Sam Bellamy passed through the colony the year before, they had been forced to cancel Governor Hamilton's tour of the Virgins. Finally, they were making the tour, but had already suffered a brush with danger. Just a few days earlier, they had encountered a pirate ship of about 26 guns and 250 men off St. Thomas. The ship flew a white ensign with a figure of a dead man spread in it, and according to Captain Rose, was commanded by none other than Olivier Labuse. Despite being outgunned and outmanned, the Seaford chased after Labuse but was unable to catch him, being outsailed by him as well. Blackbeard's men spotted the Seaford near St. Thomas on or about December 2nd and from some distance away. They identified her with certainty, probably recognizing the Navy's distinctive ensign flying from her rigging. A discussion ensued. They knew they had to outman the frigate, but to realize this advantage, they would need to board her. It was relatively easy to board a vessel if you surprised it at anchor, which is what the pirates had considered at Nevis, but it was far more risky to do so in a running battle at sea. Royal Navy gunners were well trained, able to fire their cannons twice as fast as their French and Spanish competitors. If they got off a well-timed broadside of grapeshot, they could cut down 100 men in a few seconds. On the Revenge, veteran crewmen recalled the horrific carnage they witnessed when Bonnet had attacked a Spanish man-of-war, an engagement which Bonnet had only recently recovered from. In the end, they voted against the attack, which struck them as unnecessarily risky. As the pirates would later tell a captive, they had met the man-of-war of this station, but said they had no business with her, but if she had chased them, they would have kept their way. They stuck to their course and watched the Seaford disappear. Aboard the Seaford, Captain Rose and Governor Hamilton thought they had just passed a slave ship and merchant sloop, not realizing how near they had come to danger until later that day. Approaching the island of St. Eustatius, they were hailed by a sloop sent express from St. Christopher's, 10 miles to the southeast. The sloop's crew informed the governor of the pirates' identity and their raid on Sandy Point 2 days earlier. The attack, Governor Hamilton later recalled, gave the people of St. Christopher's just apprehensions for my safety, prompting them to voluntarily outfit a 6-gun sloop to escort the Seaford back to Antigua. 100 militiamen volunteered to man her, and 10 more came aboard the Seaford to bolster her crew in the event of a boarding by pirates. As the flustered governor sailed back to Antigua, he wrote a letter to Captain Francis Hume in Barbados, begging him to immediately bring the HMS Scarborough to the Leewards to join the Seaford in hunting down the pirates. Future generations of historians would report that Blackbeard fought the Scarborough to a draw, an event seen as one of the most fantastic of his many accomplishments. The fight never happened, however, as proven by a thorough examination of the logbooks of the Scarborough and Seaford and the letters of Captains Hume and Rose. The Scarborough had pursued the pirates in the company of the Seaford, tracking Blackbeard and Bonnet's movements across the Antilles for nearly a month, but they were always more than a week behind them. They never caught up with the pirates. Instead, the naval captains received a false report that Blackbeard had been seen at Dominica near St. Vincent, which sent them on a 300-mile wild goose chase in the wrong direction. Somehow, accounts of the Seaford's close encounter with Blackbeard got mixed up with those of the Scarborough's engagements with Charles Martel and other pirates, and exaggerated into an all-out naval battle that never took place. In reality, after passing the Seaford on the morning of December 2nd, Blackbeard and Bonnet sailed to St. Croix, the pirate rendezvous used by Martel and Bellamy the year before. En route, they captured two sloops, one Danish and one English, which they took into St. Croix's harbor. There, they stayed for a night or two, regenerating their water and firewood supply, and mounting more captured cannon aboard the Queen Anne's Revenge, bringing her to 36 guns. For recreation, they also burnt the English sloop, adding her hulk to the burned-out bones of Charles Martel's pirate ship and sloops. Again, the crews of these trading vessels were not harmed. When Blackbeard was ready to leave, he put the captives aboard the Danish sloop, along with an Indian and a Negro belonging to Bermuda. The latter individuals had probably been captives for a couple of months, apparently ingratiating themselves with the pirates, for they were carrying 15 ounces of gold dust. It was stolen from them by the captains of the Danish and English sloops during their trip to Tortola. Blackbeard and Bonnet continued east, and on December 5th were off the eastern end of Puerto Rico. That day they captured one final Leeward Island sloop, the Margaret of St. Christopher, after the Queen Anne's Revenge fired a single shot over her bow. The Margaret's captain, Henry Bostock, was ordered to row over to the pirate flagship with five of his men. Bostock later gave English authorities one of the most detailed accounts of Blackbeard and his ship. The pirates did not seem to want provisions, but they did seize a number of the live cattle and hogs Bostock was carrying in his sloop, as well as his books, navigational instruments, cutlasses, and firearms. Blackbeard, Bostock reported, was a tall, sparse man with a very black beard which he wore very long. His crew numbered 300, and his flagship was a Dutch-built French Guineaman with 36 guns. There was a great deal of silver on board, as well as the fine cup taken from Captain Taylor. The pirates didn't abuse Bostock or his men, but they did force three of them to serve aboard their ship. A fourth, Robert Biddy of Liverpool, joined them voluntarily. Blackbeard interrogated Bostock and his crew, wanting to know what other merchant vessels were trading on the Puerto Rican coast. Bostock refused to talk, but Biddy and other crew members told him of French and Danish sloops they had passed on their way. Bonnet was sent ahead in the Revenge to chase them down, while Blackbeard's men finished transferring squealing hogs and unhappy cattle onto the Queen Anne's Revenge. The pirates bragged about meeting the Seaford and burning various ships and sloops. He overheard them discussing their intention to sail for Samaná Bay, Hispaniola, now within the Dominican Republic, where they would careen and lie in wait for the Spanish armada they expected would sail from Havana with money to pay the garrisons on Puerto Rico. "They think we are gone," Blackbeard said of the Spanish, "but we will soon be at their backs unawares." For some reason, Blackbeard and his men were extremely eager to learn the whereabouts of one Captain Pinkenham, whom the pirates inquired often about. Pinkenham, a sea captain with ties to Jamaica and Rhode Island, had been a privateer during the War of Spanish Succession, commanding a swift vessel with a crew of 160 men. Blackbeard would certainly have known him and may have even served on his crew, which raises the possibility that his motives for finding Pinkenham may have been more complicated than simply wanting to loot the man's vessel. Bostock's men told Blackbeard that they had last seen Pinkenham at St. Thomas, one of the Danish-controlled Virgin Islands, in an 8-gun sloop. He planned to sail to Jamaica and then on to Florida to dive the Spanish wrecks, and already had official British permission to do so. Blackbeard probably hoped to catch up to Pinkenham on his way to Jamaica. They didn't succeed. Pinkenham's sloop was later captured by a Bermudan pirate named Grinaway. Pinkenham's crew of 10 men, 2 boys, and 6 Negroes later managed to overpower and escape their captors. Bostock had one other piece of information, one that would turn the pirates' world upside down. George I was believed to have issued an act of grace, pardoning all pirates for their crimes, provided they surrender. The actual proclamation had not reached the authorities in the Leeward Islands, but there were mariners who had seen the decree back in England, where it had been published in the London Gazette 11 weeks earlier. A copy of the decree would arrive any day, Bostock told them. The pirates, Bostock later reported, listened to this news, but they seemed to slight it. The information was unsettling. It could not be otherwise. Every one of the nearly 400 men in Blackbeard's flotilla had thought they'd taken an irrevocable step into criminality and rebellion, only to discover a possibility of a second chance. Each man, Blackbeard included, must have thought about quitting piracy and retiring with their ill-gotten gains. If Blackbeard's pirates discuss this news with one another, the content of their debates has been lost to history. In fact, Henry Bostock was the last Englishman to see Blackbeard for nearly 3 months. After Blackbeard let Bostock go, the pirates sailed deeper into French and Spanish territory, and the intelligence collected by the captains of the HMS Scarborough and Seaford dried up. The last reports they received placed the pirates at Mona Island, between Puerto Rico and Hispaniola, and finally near Samaná Bay. There, Blackbeard faded out of the English records and into a Spanish world where nobody knew his name. Chapter 9. Begging Pardon, December 1717 to August 1718. Henry Bostock had not lied to Blackbeard. As part of his plan to suppress the pirates, King George I had indeed issued a royal proclamation on September 5, 1717, decreeing that any pirate who surrendered to a British governor within 1 year would be pardoned for all piracies committed before January 5, 1718. As Blackbeard sailed down the Greater Antilles, copies of this proclamation for suppressing of pirates were on their way from England aboard merchant ships bound for Boston, Charleston, and Barbados. When the ships reached their destinations, even jailed pirates would be freed. The pardons had been conceived of and promoted by Woodes Rogers, and were intended to reduce the number of active pirates prior to King George's counteroffensive. It was hoped that those pirates who took advantage of the Act of Grace would return to being productive, law-abiding subjects. Holdouts would be hunted down without mercy. King George had ordered all military and colonial personnel to seize such dead-enders, providing a reward of £100 for every pirate captain captured, plus £50 for senior pirate officers, and £20 to £30 for other members of a pirate vessel's crew. Between captures and pardons, the king's advisers reasoned the pirates of the Caribbean would be too weak to resist Rogers when he finally arrived to reestablish control of the Bahamas. Official word of the pardon reached Boston first, and the text of the proclamation was published in the Boston Newsletter of December 9, 1717. It arrived too late for the surviving members of Bellamy's crew. Through the spring and summer of 1717, the 8 prisoners waited in vain for rescue from their cages at Boston Prison. They were brought to trial in late October in the second-floor courtroom of Boston's 4-year-old townhouse, 100 yards down the street from the prison. The 2 carpenters forced from the St. Michael Thomas South and Thomas Davis, were found not guilty and released. The other six men were sentenced to hang. The condemned men spent their final 2 weeks in the company of perhaps the most influential man in all of New England, the Puritan preacher Cotton Mather. Mather, the 59-year-old scion of a family that had dominated the spiritual and political life of Massachusetts since its foundation, took an interest in the pirates. He visited them in their cells, where he subjected them to long-winded sermons, extolling their vile behavior, and accusing them falsely of murdering all their captives as their ship wrecked against Cape Cod. Throughout these meetings, one captive, Simon Van Voorst, maintained his innocence, noting that he had been a forced man. "Forced? No," Mather admonished the man at the time. "Better to have died a martyr by the cruel hands of the pirates than have become one of their brethren." Upon his return home, however, Mather scrawled a to-do note in his diary. "Obtain a reprieve, and, if it may be, a pardon for one of the pirates, who is not only more penitent, but also more innocent than the rest." If he indeed tried to obtain this pardon, the effort was unsuccessful. On the afternoon of November 15th, Mather accompanied the condemned prisoners as they walked from the prison to the Charles River ferry landing. After he heard their final confessions, the sheriffs led them out to gallows that had been erected on the tidal flats. An enormous crowd watched as the men made their final speeches. According to Mather, most were distinguishingly penitent, particularly Van Voorst, who read a psalm in his native Dutch before exhorting young persons to lead a life of religion, keep the Sabbath, and carry it well to their parents. Then the men were hanged until they were dead. "Behold," Mather wrote in a published account of their final hours, "the end of piracy." The golden age of piracy was far from over. From Boston, news of the king's pardon slowly spread in all directions. A bitter snowstorm delayed the postal riders who carried word to Rhode Island and New York, but an unnamed merchant vessel brought the news to Bermuda in little more than a week, and into the hands of Governor Benjamin Bennett. Bennett, who had long been advising his superiors in London to do something about the pirate republic in the Bahamas, took it upon himself to inform the pirates of the pardon's existence. He had copies of the proclamation printed and asked his own son to deliver them to Nassau in a swift Bermuda sloop. The governor's son was walking into the mouth of the lion, armed only with a stack of printed paper. The pirates had captured many of his countrymen's vessels and even threatened to attack Bermuda itself. If they reacted badly, young Bennett would wind up dead. By now, so many merchants were smuggling goods back and forth to the Bahamas, the pirates probably didn't give the unfamiliar sloop a second thought. Although he was the first official visitor to the island in nearly 2 years, the pirates may not have realized Bennett was there until he stepped ashore and started handing out copies of the king's offer of pardon. They were passed on to the literate among them, who read out the proclamation to those who could not. Within hours, everyone on the island must have known they had been offered a second chance. Nassau's pirates promptly broke into two contending factions. At least half of the pirates were ecstatic, greeting young Bennett as their hero and savior. This group was exemplified by Henry Jennings, who had never intended to become an outlaw in the first place, and it included Lee Ashworth, Bellamy's old quartermaster, Richard Noland, veteran pirate sloop captain Josiah Burgess, and Jean Bondave, the French pirate who had previously tried to take the captive surgeon William Howell from Hornigold. Hornigold himself was at sea when Bennett arrived, but his sympathies lay with them. This camp consisted of the more moderate pirates, former sailors and privateersmen who had fallen into piracy with profit in mind. This pro-pardon crowd was eager for the chance to regain legitimacy, free to invest their plunder in commercial trade. Backed by the dozens of captives and forced men on the island, They celebrated by climbing to the top of Fort Nassau, where they raised the Union Jack in a display of submission to the crown. The other camp was infuriated by this action. They were the diehard outlaws, bitter, angry men who saw themselves not as businessmen or thieves, but as rebels or guerrilla insurgents in a war against shipowners, merchants, and in many cases, King George himself. This anti-pardon crowd included many of the pirates who held pro-Stuart or Jacobite sympathies and had been disappointed by the collapse of the 1715 uprising against King George in the House of Hanover. This faction included Palsgrave Williams, the ruthless sloop captains Christopher Winter and Nicholas Brown, and several ambitious young men whose names would soon become infamous: Edward England, Edmund Condent, and Calico Jack Rackham. Their undisputed leader was Charles Vane. Up until now, Vane had been in the background, one of the hundreds of low-ranking pirates who caroused in the streets of Nassau, drinking, gambling, fighting, and womanizing. He had been living off his earnings while serving with Henry Jennings, particularly his shares of the plunder stolen from the Spanish wrecks in 1716. He may have gone on short cruises with other pirate captains, but it seems that he spent most of the intervening year and a half, as Jennings had, resting on his laurels ashore and appreciating the freedoms offered by the existence of the Bahamian Pirate Republic. The news of the pardon threatened to put an end to the pirate's nest, as did rumors that King George had appointed a new royal governor for the Bahamas. Vane, who had Jacobite sympathies, could not have been pleased when he read King George's proclamation. He was furious when he saw his less committed colleagues celebrating atop the fort beneath the newly raised British flag. Vane's faction rallied to the main square, which soon filled with hundreds of armed and angry men. They rushed the walls of the adjacent fort, evicted the revelers within, and pulled the Union Jack down from the flagpole. In its place, they hoisted a flag that left no ambiguity about their allegiance, the black flag with a death's head in it. Vane's faction tried to attract outside support as well. Through their network of smugglers and Jacobite contacts in England, these pirates passed a message to Captain George Cammack, a Royal Navy captain who had defected to the Pretender's cause and was now living in France. In the message, the pirates did with one heart and voice proclaim James III for their king, and were resolved to prosper or perish in their bold undertaking against George I. As Cammack would later tell it, the pirates wrote that they have rejected with contempt the said pardon. They humbly desired that the Stuarts would send to them such a person as has borne some character in the Royal Navy of England to serve as the Jacobite Captain General of America by sea and land, with the power to commission the pirates as privateers and to help organize their resistance to the Hanoverian king. With such guidance, they said, they could mount a successful surprise attack on Bermuda and secure the colony for the Stuarts. This extraordinary proposal reached Cammack via supporters in England in just 3 months. The veteran naval officer enthusiastically embraced the pirates' plan and immediately volunteered to go to Nassau himself. In a letter sent on March 28, 1718, to James Stuart's mother, the deposed Queen Mary of Modena, Cammack proposed to purchase a 50-gun warship in Cadiz for £15,000, crew her with English Jacobites, and sail to the Bahamas as a Stuart admiral. Once in Nassau, Cammack would, with James III's permission, issue a pardon for all the pirates, commissioning them as privateers instead. He would set up scheduled mailboat service between Nassau and Spain so that the exiled Stuart court could be kept in close communication with the pirates. Employing them against the common enemy will be the only means to make way for a restoration of the House of Stuart, Cammack wrote. For if we can destroy the West India and Guinea trade, we shall make the English merchants rather desire a restoration than to allow that the reign of George, the Duke of Brunswick, should continue. Events in the Bahamas, however, would overtake Kamek's plan before it ever got off the ground. The situation in Nassau remained tense throughout January 1718. Several pirate vessels returned with a number of well-laden prizes that served as a reminder of the benefits of piracy. There was the Mary Galley of Bristol, her holds packed with bottled liquor, and three large French ships carrying brandy, white wine, and claret. Hornigold brought in two well-armed Dutch merchant ships taken off Veracruz, Mexico. One had 26 guns, enough to reinforce Fort Nassau, while the other, the young Abraham of Vlissingen, Netherlands, had 40, as well as a large parcel of poorly cured animal hides, whose influence would soon affect life on Nassau. The pirates held a general council to resolve their differences, but, in the words of the author of A General History of the Pirates, there was so much noise and clamor that nothing could be agreed on. Vanescamp argued that they should fortify the island, forcing King George to negotiate while they awaited word from James Stuart's court in exile. Jennings, on the other hand, insisted that they should take the pardon and surrender without more ado, turning the island over to the royal governor whenever he showed up. The divisions so disconcerted the assembled pirates that their Congress broke up very abruptly without doing anything. After that, almost everyone on New Providence seemed to be packing up. The diehards began fitting out the ships and sloops in the harbor, preparing for what could be long and arduous cruises. Christopher Winter and Nicholas Brown were sailing to Cuba to shelter themselves among the Spaniards. Edmund Condent and 97 other men signed aboard the sloop Dragon, which they fit out for a cruise to Africa and Brazil. Vane and 16 followers acquired control of the sloop Lark and hid her in a secluded anchorage nearby where they modified her for pirate service. Meanwhile, other residents were sailing to take the pardon in neighboring British colonies. Jennings and 15 of his men went to Bermuda in the Beersheba and received pardons from Governor Bennett. Others booked passage on merchant sloops bound for South Carolina, Rhode Island, and Jamaica. Hornigold stayed in Nassau but sent a sloop to Jamaica with 80 of his men. He must have feared for his safety among the anti-pardon pirates, because he instructed the departing men to ask naval authorities in Port Royal to send a warship to Nassau for protection. By then, a Royal Navy frigate was in fact on its way, but from New York rather than Jamaica. Captain Vincent Pierce, commander of the 6th-rate HMS Phoenix, received word of the proclamation on Christmas Day during a heavy snowstorm that had slowed the postal riders from Boston. While the captains of other naval vessels took in the news of the proclamation passively, carrying on with business as usual, Pierce was young, ambitious, and ready to take the news directly to the pirates. He received the blessing of New York's governor and immediately began readying his ship, which was hunkered down for the winter, rolling guns back into place, securing supplies, and remounting topmasts and other rigging. Pierce knew his frigate would need every advantage if the pirates proved hostile. The Phoenix was one of Britain's smallest men of war. At 273 tons and 93 feet in length, she was no bigger than a large pirate ship, like the Widow or Queen Anne's Revenge, and she carried less firepower. During the previous year, the Admiralty had removed the four quarter-deck guns she had carried in wartime, leaving the frigate with only 20 six-pound cannon. She was also vulnerable to boarding, having a peacetime complement of only 90 men. Nor was she particularly well-built. As her name suggests, the Phoenix was originally built as a fire ship, intended to be filled with combustibles, set on fire, and sailed into an enemy's battle fleet, her crew planning to get away at the last moment in an escape boat. As he set sail for Nassau on the afternoon of February 5th, Captain Pierce must have hoped he wasn't getting in over his head. On the morning of February 23rd, the Phoenix arrived at the main entrance to Nassau Harbor, her men glancing nervously at the guns of the decaying fort and the death's head flag flying from its mast. Anchored in the harbor were 14 vessels flying the colors of many nations, Dutch, English, French, Spanish, and the black or red flags favored by the pirates. 5 were large ships, including the well-armed Dutch prizes brought in by Hornigold, as well as the Mary Galley, the unarmed French wine ship, and a small English merchantman. The other 9, Pierce later wrote in his log, were traitors with these pirates, but pretended they never did it till after the Act of Grace was published. Pierce ordered his lieutenant, Mr. Simmons, to assemble a landing party to take copies of the proclamation ashore. As the Phoenix's longboat slowly made its way into the harbor, Simmons holding aloft a white flag of truce, the pirates had a moment of reckoning. They could easily drive off the Phoenix. In addition to the guns in the fort, pirates were already on board the 36-gun Young Abraham and the other 26-gun Dutch ship. If they did so, there would be considerable loss of life, and none of the survivors would have any chance of obtaining a pardon. Hornigold, the most experienced and influential pirate on the island at the time, counseled a conciliatory approach. Those who wished to take the pardon and return to civilized society could do so. Those who did not could still take the pardon, using it to their advantage to buy themselves more time. The rank and file agreed. When Simmons stepped onto the beach, proclamation in hand, he was received by a great number of pirates with much civility, Pierce's logbook attests. The lieutenant read the now familiar proclamation aloud to the pirates, who greeted it with what he took to be a great deal of joy. Simmons was ashore for a few hours, during which time he was briefed by members of the pro-pardon faction. They wished to rid themselves of the inflammatory Charles Vane more than anyone else in the anti-pardon camp, and told the lieutenant how to find his secret anchorage. The pro-pardon pirates must have taken pleasure in watching the Phoenix sail out of the harbor in pursuit of their nemesis. Vane's allies watched with trepidation. Pierce found Vane's sloop tucked in behind a little islet called Busk's Cay, just where his informant said it would be. He placed the Phoenix so that it blocked the entrance to the anchorage, then gave the order to commence firing on her. Aboard the Lark, Vane's company had little choice but to surrender. As 6-pound cannonballs splashed around their little vessel, the 16 men concocted a cover story. They would tell the Phoenix's commander that they had been preparing not to go pirating, but rather to sail to Nassau to see him and learn about the king's pardon. With this in mind, Vane and his new quartermaster, a fearless Irishman named Edward England, sailed to the Phoenix and surrendered. Pierce was not fooled by Vane's story and seized the Lark in the name of King George, taking Vane and company into custody. Although the sun was setting, Pierce felt confident they could find their way back to Nassau, so the Phoenix sailed through the night, arriving in the morning. He dropped anchor in 30 feet of water, the Lark anchoring nearby. Following the protocol of the day, the pirates aboard the 2 Dutch ships fired their guns in salute of His Majesty's ship, a sign that they recognized its authority. Shortly thereafter, a number of boats rowed out from town carrying what Pierce described as their commanders and ringleaders, Hornigold, Francis Leslie, Josiah Burgess, and Thomas Nichols. Pierce recalled their conversation in his logbook later that day. They informed me that my taking the sloop had very much alarmed all the pirates in general, believing that Vane and the other men taken in her would be executed. The pirate commanders assured Pierce that if he set Vane's company free, it would be a very great means to induce the inhabitants of Nassau to surrender and accept the Act of Grace. Pierce, mindful of his tenuous position, took the pirate commander's advice and had Vane, England, and the other 14 men released, assuring them of His Majesty's goodness towards them. He kept the Lark, however, assigning some of his men to fit her out as a trading vessel. Pierce informed the pirate commanders that Woods Rogers, the famous circumnavigator who had captured a Manila galleon during the war, had been appointed governor of the Bahamas and was expected in Nassau that summer. He added that he was willing to give each man who wished to accept the king's pardon a signed certificate that would afford them some degree of protection until Rogers arrived, or while the pirates were in transit to other colonies to get pardons from their governors. Hornigold, Vane, and the other pirate commanders rowed ashore, promising to do their best to convince those ashore to take the pardon. After the pirates left, it started to rain, and continued throughout the following day. Pierce waited in his steamy cabin for word from shore. On the second morning, February 26, 1718, a stream of boats began rowing through the rain, each filled with pirates who wished to surrender. Pierce received them throughout the next 2 days, acknowledging their capitulations, signing their certificates of protection, and adding their names to a growing list of soon-to-be-pardoned pirates. The first boatloads included Hornigold, Williams, Burgess, Leslie, and Nichols, as well as Bellamy's old quartermaster, Richard Noland, and Hornigold's quartermaster, John Martin. Pierce's list grew from 50 names to 100, and eventually to 209, a veritable who's who of Golden Age pirates. It soon included most of Hornigold's original partners back in his Periagua days, Thomas Terrell, John Cockrum, and Daniel Stilwell, Henry Jennings's fellow privateer Lee Ashworth, and several men whose pirate careers were far from over, including Samuel Moody and Charles Vane. At the end of his first week in the Bahamas, Pierce felt he had gained the upper hand. Instead of the several thousand pirates he had expected to find upon his arrival, there had been only 500 young, resolute fellows, in Pierce's words, a parador of unthinking people. Many pirates had no intention of quitting piracy at all, and soon started to show signs of their impatience with the Phoenix's presence. On March 1st, Pierce raised all the frigate's signal flags, decking her out in celebration of the birthday of King George's eldest son and heir, the Prince of Wales. Some Jacobite-minded pirates responded by setting an English merchant ship on fire, spoiling the festive atmosphere. Meanwhile, Vane and his followers were quietly preparing a return to piracy. Late on the night of the 16th, he and 16 men climbed into a boat on Nassau's landing beach and rowed quietly past the Phoenix and out past the harbor's wide western entrance. The next night, 24 more pirates left to rendezvous with the Bahamas' new pirate commodore. Vane took stock of his men. Edward England, his quartermaster, was smart and courageous, a veteran mate in the merchant marine who had been forced by Christopher Winter some time earlier. He had since become a committed pirate, though he was more moderate than Vane himself. England was one of these men who seemed to have such a share of reason as should have taught him better things than to turn pirate, the author of the General History of the Pirates wrote of him. He had a great deal of good nature and did not want for courage. He would have been contented with moderate plunder and less mischievous pranks, but he was generally overruled, and as he was engaged in that abominable society, he was obliged to be a partner in all their vile actions. Vane's abominable society consisted of 40 men. John Rackham stood out from the rest because of his strange habit of wearing clothes made from brightly printed Indian calico. The other men had already taken to calling him Calico Jack. All Vane's company had were 2 boats and a pile of small arms, but then that was all Hornigold, Blackbeard, and Bellamy had had when they started out. If Captain Pierce and Governor Bennett thought piracy in the Bahamas was over, Vane had some surprises in store for them. For several days, Vane's company lurked east of Nassau, waiting for an opportunity. On March 21st, perfect conditions presented themselves. The wind was light and kept changing direction, making it possible for the pirates to overtake a sailing vessel with their rowboats. A trading sloop from Jamaica came around the eastern end of New Providence, slowly drifting toward the narrow eastern entrance of Nassau Harbor. As she passed nearby, Vane's men rowed the boats out of their hiding place and, with ropes and grappling hooks, swarmed aboard the little sloop. Her crew surrendered without a fight. The pirates now needed somewhere secure to plunder and refit their prize. They decided on Nassau Harbor, right under the nose of the troublesome Captain Pierce. Vane's men were to exploit the peculiar geography of Nassau Harbor. One of the reasons the pirates had chosen Nassau as their base was that, in addition to its main entrance to the west, the harbor offered a back door, a narrow but passable channel at its eastern end, through which a knowledgeable navigator might pass in a sloop. Near this entrance, a low sandbar called Potter's Cay split the harbor nearly in two. Any vessel drawing more than 8 feet of water could not pass over the sandy shoals on either side of this islet. The Phoenix was anchored on the western side of this shoal and was too large to cross. The pirates could sail their sloop through the eastern passage and plunder their prize behind Potter's Cay in full view of Captain Pierce. It was political theater par excellence. The renegade pirates came into the harbor, a red or bloody flag flying from the top of their mast, dropped anchor in the secure basin, and began boisterously plundering their prize in full view of the Phoenix. Vane put the sloop's crew ashore on Potter's Cay, from where they could swim to town, but they kept her captain, promising to return his little vessel as soon as they captured another more to their liking. They celebrated through the evening, the sounds of their revelry beckoning the pirates ashore to resume their illicit trade. Captain Pierce knew he was being made to look the fool. All of the Bahamas knew that he had released Vane from captivity and signed his certificate of pardon. Now he had the audacity to taunt him. Something had to be done, and quickly. He called his officers together and outlined a plan. At 1 in the morning, after the sound of the pirates' festivities had died down, Pierce armed a contingent of his men and ordered them into the largest of the Phoenix's boats. As silently as possible, they rowed across the darkened harbor, around Potter's Cay, and on toward the pirate sloop, hoping to catch her by surprise. Vane had posted a watch, however, and as the naval party came within musket range, they were greeted with a fusillade of small arms fire. The Phoenix's men returned fire, but after a few exchanges, it was clear that the pirates were far too strong for them, and they had to make a hasty retreat. The Royal Navy had tried to flex its muscles, but had been forced to run instead. This brief engagement greatly boosted the morale of Nassau's pirates. Suddenly, the man of war looked vulnerable, and Vane's men heroic. Overnight, the mood shifted from resignation to defiance. I several times summoned the inhabitants together in His Majesty's name and used all the arguments possible to prevail with them to assist me in suppressing the said pirate, he later wrote. But they always rejected all methods I proposed. They entertained and assisted Vane's company with provisions and necessaries, and on all occasions showed no small hatred to government. From then on, Pierce's situation deteriorated. On the evening of March 23rd, he left the harbor to convoy 4 sloops safely out of the Bahamas. He had a personal interest in one of them, Vane's sloop, the Lark, which he had crewed with sailors from the Phoenix for a private, for-profit trading mission to St. Augustine. When he returned 6 days later, he discovered a further affront to his authority. Nassau's pirates had burned the young Abraham and the Mary Galley, and had run the 26-gun Dutch ship aground on Hog Island. On March 31st, Vane returned to his sanctuary in the eastern basin of Nassau Harbor to taunt Pierce with his latest prize, the Lark, which he had captured despite Pierce's efforts. Most worrisome, 3 of the Royal Navy sailors he had put aboard the Lark had defected to Vane's crew. Not only was Pierce outmanned and outgunned, he had to worry that his own sailors were regarding the pirates as heroes. As they transferred cannon and supplies to the Largue, Vane's men yelled insults at the Phoenix, which Vane loudly threatened to burn. Then they boldly rode across the western basin to town, passing near the man-of-war. Pierce opened fire at the boat with both cannonballs and partridge shot and ordered the pirates to come aboard the Phoenix. They ignored these orders and the ordnance splashing in the water around them and proceeded to town. In just 3 days, Vane's gang grew from 19 to upward of 75. During this time, he also captured 2 more sloops whose captains, unaware of the danger, had anchored alongside the pirates. Pierce tried to warn the sloops by hoisting his topgallant sails with sheets flying, but to no avail. On April 4th, Vane raised a black flag to the masthead of the Largue and sailed out to sea. With a nimble 6-gun sloop and a proper company of men, Vane was in a position to bring all commerce in the Bahamas to a standstill. He had little sympathy for his victims, especially the merchant smugglers of Harbor Island, who had capitulated to Pierce the moment he showed the British ensign. They would pay a price for their disloyalty to the Pirate Republic. Even with Vane gone, Captain Pierce found himself in an untenable position. The pirates have altered their treatment and sent threateningly to the captain to be gone or it should be worse for him, Governor Bennett reported after debriefing pirates who sought pardon in Bermuda. I conclude all have surrendered that intends to, and I fear they will soon multiply, for too many sailors are willing to join with them when their vessels are taken. Pierce did his best not to show weakness, but on April 6th, his carpenter accidentally set the Phoenix on fire while boiling tar in the galley. The crew quickly got the fire under control, but the symbolic damage was irreparable. 2 days later, the Phoenix raised its anchors and, in the company of 5 merchant sloops, sailed out of the harbor, bound for New York. In a final embarrassment to the captain, he ran aground on the way out. For a few hours, the residents of Nassau watched the Phoenix's men work to free her. Then she was gone, leaving Nassau in pirate hands once again.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 9.